marching home again. Hurrah, hurrah, we'll give them a hearty welcome then. Hurrah, hurrah, oh, the men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes marching home. And we'll all...
Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It was 150 years ago today that the Battle of Gettysburg began. It went on for 3 days, a very bloody battle and a very consequential battle in the Civil War. General Abner Doubleday described the fighting in this battle as being the most desperate which ever took place in the world. There are many commemorations taking place in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the next 3 days. Actually, they started yesterday. And today we are going to be talking about the importance of this battle historically and how it turned the tide of the Civil War. We'll have two guests with us. Chris Brenneman is from the Gettysburg Foundation, a nonprofit group that operates the museum and the visitors center for the Gettysburg National Military Park. We took some listeners to Gettysburg a couple years ago, and I think I speak for everybody in saying that we were all extraordinarily moved standing on that ground and listening to our wonderful guide. Our guest, Chris, is also the author of the forthcoming book, The Gettysburg Cyclorama, a Photographic Study. Chris, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi. Well, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on with you today.
Pleasure to have you here. Paul McKee is also with us, a local Civil War researcher and member of the Mazamani Historical Society Board of Directors. The Iron Brigade played a big role in today's battle 150 years ago at Gettysburg. We'll talk about that and more with Paul. Hello, Paul. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen, and welcome to the afternoon.
Thank you. That's right. We switched to the afternoons. It still seems like mornings to me, but thank you. Let's start with you, Chris. Why was Gettysburg the site of a battle? Did Robert E. Lee choose that area? Did it happen by chance?
It really happened by chance. If you look at a map, there's 10 major roads that lead into Gettysburg, and they come from every direction, almost like the spokes of a wheel. And those roads are going to kind of funnel the armies towards Gettysburg. And what happens is the battle sort of starts by chance, but once it starts, because the roads are funneling so many troops towards the same place, it quickly starts to snowball out of control. And it's really the geography and the road network almost makes a battle in Gettysburg inevitable once you're in this county.
Mm-hmm. And the battle has been described as such an important part of turning the tide of the Civil War. We'll talk in a little while about how perhaps General Meade could have done more. But in terms of boosting morale and changing the way things were going, this was really important. Paul, can you describe what the state of the morale of Union soldiers before Gettysburg? They weren't feeling great, were they?
No, after 2 years of suffering a series of defeats and stalemates throughout those years of the war, morale seemed rather low, and they were probably thinking, is this going to happen again? Is this going to be another defeat? Is this going to be another retreat back to Washington? So, morale was rather low at that time.
Mm-hmm. And Robert E. Lee, give us the background on this, Chris, decided that a battle in Union territory was important strategy on his part. Maybe he should have thought twice about it if he didn't know what was going to happen. But why did he decide that he had to go to the north?
Well, there was a couple reasons. One would be the psychological impact. He's been winning battle after battle down there in the south. But if he could actually move into the north and defeat the Northern Army on its own turf, the psychological blowback of that would have been immense. In other words, if he can march into Pennsylvania and beat the Northern Army, where is he going to go next? Next thing, he'll go into Ohio. He'll be taking major cities. And the north has been losing so many battles that one more defeat could really tip the tide of public sentiment. So there's a psychological impact. Also, another big thing is the supply factor. He's been fighting down in northern Virginia for 2 years, and the northern part of Virginia has been almost picked clean. And he's having trouble getting enough supplies to properly feed his men down there in Virginia. But once he moves up into Pennsylvania, the area is untouched. There's plenty of livestock, you know, grains that are just being harvested, all kinds of good stuff to eat that he can seize from the citizens of Pennsylvania. And his army is going to be eating off of things they take from Pennsylvania well into 1864.
Hmm.
So the supplies are another big factor.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at two other supporting actors in all of this who, it seems to me, were very important. One because he failed to do his job, and the other because he saw an area that could be important to the Union. Jeb Stuart, who, I don't know what the heck he was doing, but he failed to get the intelligence of the Union strength to Robert E. Lee. John Buford, on the other hand, rode into Gettysburg and saw that there were highly defensible positions along Cemetery Ridge and decided to stake out that ground for a Union position in the battle to come, which really was a very good decision. Start, whoever wants to start, Paul, maybe you do on this. Where was Jeb Stuart?
Well, I've got to preface what I say here is I am not necessarily a Gettysburg scholar per se, but I'm a material culture researcher. As far as Jeb Stuart, he was off basically not in contact with Lee,
mm-hmm.
and basically Lee had lost his eyes and ears to know exactly where the Federals were at the time. Federals pacing the Confederate Army into the north, and so it was kind of like stumbling into each other blindly. Chris, would you agree?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Jeb Stuart was trying to ride around the Northern Army and disrupt their communications, perhaps throw General Meade's plan off a little bit. But it took him longer to go around the north than he anticipated. And the Northern Army was marching faster than it had ever marched before. So it's not just Stuart's, let's say, error, but it's also the north is marching harder and more competently maybe than they've ever done in the past. And because he gets out of contact with Lee, Lee goes into the battle blind.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is Stuart does leave behind some cavalry with General Lee, but that cavalry stays down in Virginia and is still guarding the rear of the Northern Army and really kind of doesn't follow their orders and keep up with the rest of the army. So in a way, it's not just Stuart leaving guys behind. He doesn't leave some of his best guys behind that maybe could have gotten Lee some better information.
What you just said is so remarkable that he left this renowned general blind. He left Robert E. Lee blind in going into this enormous battle.
Yeah, it was definitely an error that's hard to estimate what might have happened different if Lee had known a little more clearly right. What was going on.
Yeah. And Buford, on the other hand, riding into Gettysburg, looks around and finds this high point which he takes and realizes, thinking ahead, this could be very important ground to establish your presence as this battle begins.
Yeah, I mean, General Buford, he really kind of is looking into the future about 24 hours and predicting what's going to happen the next day. And he gets it right on, and by sort of, guessing ahead, he really does predict what's going to happen and kind of throws a monkey wrench into Lee's gears, so to speak, a day ahead.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit, if we could please, Paul, about the Iron Brigade. It included a lot of men from the state of Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Interested in how ferociously they fought, how respected they were, and how far they had to walk with virtually nothing on their, hardly anything. They weren't carrying anything for a long, long ways to get to Gettysburg. They were important in the early hours of July 1st, 1863, weren't they?
Absolutely. One has to keep in mind that there was a distinct difference between the Eastern armies and the Western armies. At that time, Wisconsin was part of the West, was what we now call the Midwest. And very early on in the Civil War, there was a plan to put together a brigade of only Wisconsin troops. In a very young state, it was only 13 years, and a population of like 775,000 individuals, yet 90,000 Wisconsin troops served during the Civil War. Of that brigade, the 2nd Wisconsin, the 6th Wisconsin, the 7th Wisconsin served together in the East. And they had something to prove. Westerners were considered uncouth backwoodsmen.
Right. Yeah,
and basically they were there to prove something. And after serving brilliantly at South Mountain at their first fight, actually, at Brawner's Farm, fighting their way up South Mountain, Antietam, Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg. Now they were in the Gettysburg campaign, and they were among the very first infantry troops to arrive on the field that first day 150 years ago.
And they suffered enormous losses today, didn't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. If I may, Kathleen, I'm with the Mazomania Historical Society, and this weekend we are actually doing a Civil War cemetery walk.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the individuals we're featuring in the cemetery walk is a gentleman by the name of Henry Schilt, who served in the 6th Wisconsin Infantry. Very colorful character, and his experience on the first day is kind of very symbolic of what Wisconsin experienced at Gettysburg. Schilt himself was like a veteran of the German Army. He was born in Prussia, served for 6 years in the German Army, immigrated with his wife and children to Wisconsin, and where he tried his hand at farming. When the Civil War broke out, he wasn't all caught up in the fever that his neighbors were and go out and enlist immediately in 1861. He, being an older man with a family and a veteran, he knew about what war was like. But he did enlist eventually in 1862, and he joined the 6th Wisconsin Infantry in Company F, primarily made up of Germans from Milwaukee.
Hmm.
So he served in the Iron Brigade and served in the early battles all the way up to Gettysburg. And he was present with the 6th Wisconsin, which was held in reserve as the rest of the brigade had advanced up McPherson's Ridge into Herbst Woods. During that fight, which was just a heavy fight, a lot of casualties going on, tore up the brigade, nearly destroyed the brigade, the 6th Wisconsin was detached, sent over to the right, where the federal right was crumbling apart. Cutler's brigade was getting overrun and retreating pell-mell from the area called the Railroad Cut,
mm-hmm.
which parallels the Chambersburg Pike. And there, Henry Schilt, who was a sergeant at the time, during the charge against the railroad cut, where the 2nd Mississippi was using this unfinished railroad cut as a trench to fire on them from, the 6th Wisconsin charged that, and as he turned, put a percussion cap on his musket. A 69 caliber buck and ball entered his rib cage on the lower left, exited underneath his right shoulder blade, and he crumbled and fell and left for dead on the battlefield. In fact, in the reports, he was reported dead. The entire brigade eventually retreated back to Cemetery Ridge, leaving Schilt on the field. Well, when news got home that he had died at Gettysburg, they had a funeral for him. And we're billing him as the man who died twice. I don't want to give away too much about it, but he did have two funerals. They were 47 years apart.
Oh, my goodness.
Apart.
Oh, my. It's quite a story, isn't it? Quite a story. Who fired the first shot, Chris?
The first shot of the battle was fired by a lieutenant from Illinois. His name was Lieutenant Marcellus Jones. He was part of Buford's cavalry. He borrowed a rifle from a sergeant, leaned it on a fence, and at about 7 a.m. on July the 1st, he fired the first shot of the battle. They estimate 7 million more bullets were fired after that first shot.
Whoa, are you serious? 7 million?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And I'm glad you mentioned the Iron Brigade, because they're one of my favorite units in this battle. Of course, he was talking about the 6th Wisconsin, which was commanded by a guy named Rufus Dawes. His great-grandfather was a guy named William Dawes, who made the midnight ride out of Boston with Paul Revere. Another interesting piece of trivia, the grandson of Paul Revere, Paul Joseph Revere, was killed here at Gettysburg leading the 20th Massachusetts Regiment.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So both of the descendants of the midnight ride out of Boston, their grandson and great-grandson, ended up here in the Battle of Gettysburg. Rufus does survive. He goes on to write a book called A Full-Blown Yankee of the Iron Brigade, My Service with the 6th Wisconsin Infantry. That's a really excellent book that you can still get today. And he does a great job of describing the various campaigns and marches and, you know, all aspects of Army life.
We welcome phone calls for our two guests. Today marks the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Battle of Gettysburg, which lasted 3 days and was such an important battle, not only for turning the course of the war and also for giving the Union soldiers a lift, also because of the nature of what happened in November when Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, which we will listen to all of it a little bit later. Not from Lincoln, we don't have that recording, but from somebody reading the Gettysburg Address, an extraordinary work of what war is for and what everybody was fighting for and honoring those who were at that battlefield, the National Cemetery. So here's our phone number. I'm sure many of you listening have been to Gettysburg. They're having 150th commemoration events all of this week. Last night, Doris Kearns Goodwin spoke. She, of course, the author of Team of Rivals, a great book about Abraham Lincoln. And you were moved. You can't help but be really moved by what happened at Gettysburg and the way it's preserved the whole battlefield as well. We're talking about that this hour of the show. Here's how you join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, and some people have already. They have put some of the photos of the Battle of Gettysburg on our Facebook page, which are good to look at. So we'll be taking all of your messages in just one moment. And speaking of the Iron Brigade, this is a song that they may have been listening to as they were marching into battle or were getting ready for battle. We're talking about Gettysburg this hour because today, 150 years ago, this day was the start of the Battle of Gettysburg. And here's our number, 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us, Chris Brenneman from the Gettysburg Foundation. It's a nonprofit group operating the Museum and Visitors Center for the Gettysburg National Military Park. Chris is author of the forthcoming book, The Gettysburg Cyclorama, a photographic study. And Paul McKee is also with us, a local Civil War researcher, member of the Mazamani Historical Society's board of directors. We go to Phil in McHenry, Illinois first. Hi, Phil.
Hi, excellent show, one of my favorite topics. I've got a quick question for you. I was watching on C-SPAN the all-day thing yesterday from Gettysburg. They had a lot of authors and experts on. The first fellow who presented anything that was a historian from Louisville, Kentucky. And everything I've ever read, and I've read everything I can on Gettysburg and the Civil War, says that Reynolds chose Gettysburg, that he wanted to fight at Gettysburg, and that's why Bruford was at Gettysburg, because he was under Reynolds' command. And this fella did some research. He was writing a book about General Meade, and he was at the National Archives. And at the National Archives, they presented him with the contents of the pockets of General Reynolds when he was killed on the first day of the battle, letters and correspondence. In his pockets was a letter from General Meade, and a letter he intended to send out to all commanders with his corps, saying, let us engage at Gettysburg and let us withdraw as is practical and fall back on other corps until we get to Emmitsburg and the creek at Emmitsburg. And Meade concurred with that idea, and this fellow presented that this was classic military techniques, and perhaps if Reynolds had lived, we'd be talking about the Battle of Emmitsburg, not the Battle of Gettysburg.
Oh, interesting. Chris, what do you say?
Well, I think there could be a lot of credence to that theory. It was General Buford that really kind of saw that Gettysburg might be a good place to fight a battle, or at the very least to delay the Confederates. General Reynolds would have had the discretion to either move the whole army to Gettysburg or some point in between Gettysburg and, say, the Maryland line. And it is very possible that he intended to fight his way back to Emmitsburg, but because Reynolds is killed so quickly in the fighting, he never gets a chance to develop whatever his plan might have been. And since he never really had time to share it with all his subordinates, once he gets killed, they just assume that the plan is to fight at Gettysburg. And right.
I'm sorry, are you listening to somebody?
Chris? Yes, I could hear Paul.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks. Thanks very much. Paul, go ahead.
No, I was saying that Doubleday was left guessing what the intentions were of Reynolds, and he made the assumption. He had no correspondence. He had no conversation because Reynolds was dead by that time.
Hmm. Let's talk about Meade for a moment here, jumping ahead to a couple days from now when this war ended. I was reading some of Team of Rivals last night, and she was talking about the fact that Washington, it was hard to get the news. It was very slow in coming. Nobody really knew how the Union troops were doing. But at the end, and he never sent this letter, which I think is interesting, Abraham Lincoln wrote a letter to General Meade expressing gratitude for the magnificent success, but acknowledging that he was distressed immeasurably by the magnitude of the misfortune of Lee's escape. That if that had not happened, it may have lessened the length of this war. It may have ended the war right then. Can both of you describe why Meade wasn't on Lee's tail right away here, and if indeed it was a horrible thing for him to have dilly-dallied around so that Lee could escape? It could have been the end of the war completely. What do you think about that, Paul?
I think that the Army of the Potomac under Meade was pretty much played out. They were as tired from victory as Lee would have been from defeat. It would have been very difficult for him to really pursue heavily, even though Lincoln wanted him to.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I definitely agree with Paul. You know, they had outmarched a lot of their supply wagons. Some of the men haven't eaten any food for days. They had lost a lot of their, real key commanders. General Hancock is injured. General Reynolds is dead.
Right.
So, they're disorganized by victory as much as Lee is disorganized by defeat. Another big factor is there's a mountain range just west of town. And once Lee crosses that mountain range, he can block the mountain passes with a relatively small amount of men to hold off the much larger northern army. So for Meade to pursue, he has to march south and then march west, and it gives him a much longer pursuit route. And I think Meade does pursue Lee pretty aggressively, but it's just not possible with the state of his army and the terrain that he has to cross. He's just not able to stop Lee, but I think he tries.
Let's go to more phone calls. Arlene is next in Platteville. Hi, Arlene.
Hi there. Thank you for this wonderful program. There are many people who are really fans of the brigade, but there are also those people who think that the 2nd Brigade is the one that's kind of overlooked at times and its significance. If you could address that, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Is the caller referring to Cutler's Brigade, I assume?
I think so.
Yes, that's Cutler's Brigade. He was originally the colonel of the 6th Wisconsin, and he was the one that was actually on the federal right this first day of Gettysburg 150 years ago and had to withstand severe attacks, and parts of his brigade surrounded on three sides. Heavy casualties there. But again, Cutler's brigade had to retire, and they were being pushed heavily, and the 6th Wisconsin is being credited saving the federal right from total annihilation at that hour on the battlefield of Gettysburg.
Thank you very much, Arlene, for the call. I know you're having some remarkable dedications and historical moments on Gettysburg battlefield today and tomorrow and also on Wednesday. I'm interested if you could tell us, Chris, how this battlefield, and thank goodness it has been, happened to be restored the way that it is. It goes on. You get the sense of what happened there. It's a lot of space. Why did that get preserved the way that it has been?
Well, it's really been an ongoing process ever since the day the battle ended. No sooner was the battle over and some local citizens bought some of the land and then ended up partnering with veterans groups to create what was called the Gettysburg Battlefield Memorial Association. And by the 25th anniversary of the battle, the association was controlled by the GAR, which was the Grand Army of the Republic. It was like the VFW of those days. And the veterans bought up pieces of the battlefield and put their monuments up around the battlefield. So, you know, it was the efforts of those veterans that really preserved a lot of the land. Eventually, they gave it to the federal government in 1895, and it became the Gettysburg National Military Park. But the land that was in between where the monuments are was just farmland, and they figured it would always be just farmland. But then in the 1900s, in the 40s, 50s, into the 60s, a lot of that land got bought up and got commercialized. And there were gas stations and hotels.
Oh, my.
Souvenir shops right in the middle of the battlefield.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then local groups, you know, groups from around the country started donating money to buy up and preserve the land. And initially it was called the Friends of Gettysburg, which is now the Gettysburg Foundation that I work for.
Mm-hmm.
And they repurchased a lot of land and turned it back into battlefield. So, you know, it's really been an ongoing process through the last 150 years till today. Really, most of the areas where the key fighting took place is owned by the battlefield and is kept in its historic appearance.
It sure is.
Also, the park and the Gettysburg Foundation have worked together to create this new museum and to cut down a lot of trees that had grown up in non-historic areas and replant orchard trees and other trees that were here in the proper places. Hmm. So the foliage has undergone an evolution over the years as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Kevin next in. Where are you from, Kevin? Port Wing?
Port Wing.
Port Wing. Hi,
beautiful
Kevin.
Port Wing in Bayfield County. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Wonderful.
Good.
I would like to thank your guest if he's doing anything to fight the commercial development in and around Gettysburg, i.e. either Walmart or the condominiums or hotel they want that you have, if you have fought to preserve that area, I want to thank you very much. And I also would like to mention that there was a huge battle before Gettysburg at Chancellorsville that was really the precursor where the Confederate troops were almost forced to go that way, even though they were invading Pennsylvania at the time. But that Chancellorsville battle was, a lot of people consider that a Confederate victory.
Mm-hmm.
And there was payback the Union wanted to give to the Confederates, and if they could get him, they would. And I would like to thank the sacrifices of the Iron Brigade, especially Lieutenant Alonzo Cushing, Arthur MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur's father.
Mm-hmm.
They were all there, and they did a great job representing Wisconsin. But I would also ask your guest if you could possibly mention the Battle of Vicksburg that was going on at the same time, even though there was five times as less people killed at Vicksburg. When Vicksburg surrendered on July 3rd, it really was the end of the Confederacy because they could not receive any supplies, ammunition, food, anything down the Mississippi River, and that was really the demise of the Confederacy. And I'll take your response.
Thank you.
Here.
Interesting point, Paul. Would you say that was the demise of the Confederacy, the Vicksburg loss by the Confederacy?
First, I want to thank that caller for raising that point. This date is actually quite monumental on three different fronts. Without taking away anything from Gettysburg, which was absolutely important in saving the Union and the Army of the Potomac, there was also the Tullahoma campaign that was going on this very day, 150 years ago, which was a brilliant campaign of maneuver by General Rosecrans against the center of the South, which eventually ended up in almost the bloodless loss of Chattanooga when it was captured by the Federals, which was an important rail juncture during the Civil War. At the same time, too, was the Siege of Vicksburg, which on July 4th of 1863 fell to Federal forces. Majority of Wisconsin troops did serve in the West, and there were quite a few, some 10,000 Wisconsin troops that served at Vicksburg. And once Vicksburg fell, the entire Mississippi River had fallen into Federal hands, all the way from New Orleans, all the way through Vicksburg and Memphis, virtually cutting the Confederacy in half and denying that supply line to the Confederacy. So there was a lot that was going on during the Civil War 150 years ago on this very date.
Well, if that was the case, Chris, let me give this one to you. Why the heck did the war go on for another 2 years?
Well, it really became, at that point, it started to become a war of attrition.
Hmm.
And the South wasn't willing to give up, and they still had significant armies in the field. But the North just kept hammering away at them. And in a lot of the later battles in the Civil War, especially here in the East, in many of the battles, the North loses twice as many men as the South does. But the North has the manpower to replace their losses, and the South doesn't. And even though, let's say, the writing was on the wall by the end of 1863, the South wasn't willing to give up until, you know, they were almost ground down to nothing left.
Let's go next to Ken is joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
I have to say that I'm on a cell phone here, and I hope it sort of works.
You're okay now, sir.
You can hear me?
Yes, sir, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, in the Milwaukee Journal of this past Saturday, there was a nice colored picture entitled Johnny Rebs Take a Rest. And it shows members of the 1st Tennessee that must have been helping in this reconstruction of, that we're going to see now of the battles. They are taking a rest, a whole bunch of troops. They're dressed as troops, and they maybe they did come from Tennessee like others came from Wisconsin. In this case, they were Rebs, though, and it shows them relaxing on the battlefield in a nice colored picture in the journal.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I wanted to just mention. And the other thing is the German troops. It was mentioned that Wisconsin had German troops, which you might expect, that had joined to go to that battlefield of the Civil War. Well, I happen to have a great-great-grandfather, Hermann Fleckenstein, from Germany, who had the good luck of emigrating to the United States in 1861, just before Fort Sumter was fired upon.
Uh-huh.
And he moved, of all places, to Richmond, Virginia.
Oh.
So he joined other Germans in the 1st Virginia Infantry, which was a heavily German unit, even in the South. So that was just interesting, I thought.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for the call. That's the thing that gets to you is this whole thing of brother against brother, of people, you know, from the same country engaged in this bloody, horrendous battle. It just, it's hard to take that in, isn't it, Paul?
It's very interesting to see. There's one thing about the Civil War that's always fascinated me is it brings out the worst in some people and brings out the very best in others that rise to the occasion. There's some great lessons to be learned in leadership and values, and the emotional human interest side of the Civil War really does fascinate me considerably.
Mm-hmm. What about you? How do you take it all in, Chris, brother against brother?
You know, it's really tragic. It makes you sad that almost everywhere you look, you find that brothers are fighting their brothers, friends are fighting their friends, cousins are fighting their cousins. And there's cases of that all over the battlefield here at Gettysburg. I'm glad the last caller mentioned his the German immigrant that fought for the South. There's an interesting story on the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg up near Oak Ridge on the northern part of the battlefield. There's a German immigrant, and he's from New York. And when he came into the country with his brother, they got off the ship in New York. His brother ended up moving to the South. At the Battle of Gettysburg, he captures his own brother near Oak Ridge. His brother is marched off to the rear as a prisoner. They talk for a few minutes. Within an hour, the northern guy gets killed in the fighting. So that was the only time after those two brothers had parted ways in New York City that they met again here in the United States, was just for a brief time at Gettysburg, and then one ends up captured, one ends up killed. So it's really emotional.
Yeah, the whole thing is very emotional. 150 years later, it will be forevermore. More phone calls momentarily. We are talking about the Battle of Gettysburg because today marks the 150th anniversary on this day, July 1st, of the beginning of the Battle of Gettysburg, an extremely important battlefield, and of course later the important grounds on which Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address, which we will hear in its entirety in just a few moments. He had been asked to say a few words to consecrate the cemetery grounds that were set aside so that Union soldiers who'd been interred near the battlefield and hospitals could be properly buried. We have two guests with us this hour of the show. Chris Brenneman from the Gettysburg Foundation, nonprofit group operating the Museum and Visitors Center for the Gettysburg National Military Park, and author of a book forthcoming, The Gettysburg Cyclorama. Paul McKee, local Civil War researcher and member of the Ms. Maney Historical Society Board of Directors. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. We cannot do this hour without listening to It's Not Abraham Lincoln. I wish we could hear Abraham Lincoln doing the Gettysburg Address, but we will be hearing Sam Waterston doing the Gettysburg Address. And if you would please, Chris, for those of you who haven't had a chance to stand on the Gettysburg grounds where he gave the address, I highly recommend it. It's just an incredibly moving experience. But if you would please, before we hear the Gettysburg Address, Chris, tell us more about why Lincoln was there and when he gave this address and why it will be with us for all times.
Well, he was invited to the dedication ceremony for the groundbreaking of the National Cemetery on November the 19th, 1863, about 4 months after the battle. And he wasn't the main speaker that day. The main speaker was a guy named Edward Everett. Lincoln was just supposed to give a few appropriate remarks. So he wasn't intended to give a real long speech, but he really took it seriously and spent a lot of time preparing the Gettysburg Address. It is known he put the finishing touches on it the night before the address here in Gettysburg, but there used to be myths that he wrote the address on the way here on the back of an envelope.
Right.
That's not true. He really did think it through and carefully prepared for the Gettysburg Address. But he wasn't the main speaker. The main speaker was Edward Everett, who gave a two-hour speech about the Battle of Gettysburg. And I've read Mr. Everett's speech. I mean, he makes references to things in the Bible, the Greeks, the Romans, you name it. Edward Everett probably covers it sometime in his speech. When he gets done, then Lincoln stands up and gives the very short but, you know, incredibly important Gettysburg Address. Edward Everett tells Lincoln, "I wish I could have come so close to the meaning of the event in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes." And it is an incredibly important speech. In a way, it kind of redefines the Civil War. Why is all this death and destruction and terrible things happening? And what does it all mean? And it kind of redefines the purpose of the war. And in a way, it almost redefines our country to this day forward.
And here it is.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, read by Sam Waterston. Julie is our next caller. Hello, Julie from Mazamani. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm so pleased you're having this show.
So am I. I'm happy to.
I wanted to comment a little bit on the kindness that was mentioned earlier. Some of the, you know, there's brother against brother, but then there are people reaching out as brothers and sisters. During war in general, there was actually an occasion during the Civil War, right in our little Mazamani, where the women of Mazamani found out that there was a train of Confederate soldiers, Confederate prisoners, being brought through town on their way to Camp Randall. And this was in a day when they could not get on Facebook, they could not send out a mass email or call each other on the cell phone, but somehow the women of Mazamani managed to coordinate and get together and cook a big dinner for these hungry, depressed Confederate prisoners and take the time to feed them when that train stopped in Mazamani. And I think it speaks well for the town, but there are other things like that also happened during the war that I think really speaks well for human kindness.
Mm. Paul, you want to comment on that?
Yes, those were prisoners from Island Number 10 that were shipped up the Mississippi River and put on rail to go to prison camp at Camp Randall during the war. And in the course of their travels, they passed through Mazamani, and this happened. And there's many instances of kindness that were being shown to the prisoners, and not only in Camp Randall by the local citizens, but even at some of the other prison camps as well. Julie's very correct, and that did happen.
Where did that kindness come from? Because you could understand, I think, Chris, an opposite feeling and an opposite reaction.
Well, I think you know, they're thinking of their sons, their brothers, their uncles that are away in the war, and they're thinking that if their relatives were captured and they were passing through some town in the South, they would want someone to do the same thing for them. Even though they're the enemy, they're still, you know, they're still boys away from home. And they're thinking how lonely, you know, their spouses or relatives might be.
Yes.
And how that would cheer them up. And there is a lot of examples of that. And especially like here at Gettysburg, after the battle, with the way they care for the wounded. And it's not great at first, but they're doing all they can to take care of not only the northern wounded, but the southern wounded.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Julie, so much for your call. Art in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Art.
Hi. Well, it is really moving to hear the Gettysburg Address and the final comments about rededicating ourselves to a new freedom for this country, which has been partially fulfilled, but not fully. I just want to invite anyone who's in Milwaukee or visits Milwaukee to stop by Milwaukee Turner Hall. There is a, on the first landing going up to the ballroom, a monument to the members, over 20 members of Milwaukee Turners who gave their lives, including where they died, some at Gettysburg, marked on the memorial. And the founder of the Turners was a general in the Union Army, and while there were German-Americans on both sides, I think there were half a dozen major generals or generals who were members of the Turners alone, including Lincoln's bodyguard. So if anyone wants to check that out, if they go to a concert in the ballroom or 4th Street Forum or just for a fish fry, It's kind of a moving monument.
I'm sure it is. I wasn't aware it was there, Art. Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. There were a lot of higher-ups in the military on both sides who were killed in the Battle of Gettysburg. Was that because the enemy, depending on your point of view, was so close?
Well, I think the generals were trying to lead their men by example. And, you know, by showing that they weren't afraid, that helped their men not be afraid. And the Civil War was probably the last time where you'll see generals leading right from the front, because they lose so many generals because of that. And I think the military in general kind of learns that if you're that important, you have to be a little bit farther to the rear. But at this time, they still believe that by showing a heroic example, it's going to inspire their men to be that much more heroic.
If I could add to that?
Yes, please.
Gettysburg is not unique with that kind of heroism and needing to lead by example by general officers. Many battles, the officers would have to take matters into their own hands, grabbing the colors of a demoralized regiment and waving it at their front and leading the charge. Keep in mind, I believe it's 7 Confederate generals died at the Battle of Franklin in 1864 after doing multiple charges against the Federal trenches at Franklin. It happened quite a bit during the Civil War, and you lead by example. You can't always lead from the rear.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Art, for your call. Dave in Delafield, hi.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for taking my call.
You are welcome.
Two quick things. The new Welcome Center in Gettysburg is just amazing. Yeah, kudos to everybody involved with that. And although I do miss the map of lights. I don't know. Any comment if that'll ever make a comeback? But also, there's something very exciting going on in the area. A Delafield native, Alonzo Cushing, who an earlier caller mentioned, a 30-year battle to get the have him receive the Medal of Honor is alive and well, and our Wisconsin representatives, Kine, Sensenbrenner, Johnson, and Baldwin, senators, are actively pushing to get that as an attachment to the upcoming defense budget. And I don't know if the guests have any comments about Alonzo Cushing.
Well, two things. Thank you for complimenting our museum. We're very proud of the job that they did creating the museum. In regards to the electric map, it has been bought by a gentleman in Hanover, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles east of here, who's restoring it and is going to put it on display in downtown Hanover.
Oh.
It should be opening very soon, probably sometime this summer. In regards to Cushing, they've been fighting to try to get his Medal of Honor now for a couple years, and they've been having trouble getting it through Congress. But if there's ever a person that deserves the Medal of Honor, certainly Alonzo Cushing showed an amazing bravery here at Gettysburg. So I hope that they're able to get that through.
And they ought to be, because it is a rare, completely bipartisan effort, it sounds like. So it ought to happen. You got everybody from all sides. Let's just briefly talk about where we were at this moment in the Battle of Gettysburg and when the battle ended. Chris?
Well, if it would have been this time of the day, the Northern Army would have been starting to get pushed back through the town.
Hmm.
And at this point, it would have been a very chaotic moment in the battle. The northern forces were retreating through the town. The southern advance was hot on their heels. And as they start to emerge on the other side of town, fortunately there's Cemetery Hill and Cemetery Ridge and some real good terrain that the North starts to reform on. But this would be the moment in the battle where the South really tastes victory in the air. And you know, if they could have pushed their advantage just a little bit more, mm-hmm. they might have been able to push the North back out of town and off those hills beyond the town.
Wow. And
fortunately, the North is able to rally.
And then who knows what might have happened, right? Thank you both so much for being with us. I'd like to go on all day, but we can go to books next, I guess. Thank you very much. Chris Brenneman, thanks. From the Gettysburg Foundation, a nonprofit group for the museum. It operates the museum and visitor center for the Gettysburg National Military Park. And we also thank Paul McKee, local Civil War researcher and member of the Mazamani Historical Society Board of Directors. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for helping putting this show together. Thanks to you for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow.